Between client meetings, managing your business, and everyday tasks, who has time to worry about website hosting? With Kinsta's Managed WordPress hosting, you don't have to. They handle the technical stuff, delivering lightning-fast load times, enterprise-grade security, and 24/7, 365 human-only support. Simply switching to Kinsta can make your site up to 200% faster. Kinsta's custom dashboard makes managing sites easy, with powerful features designed to save you time and effort. Plus, their free expert-led migrations ensure a smooth transition. Ready to see why Kinsta is trusted by thousands of businesses? Get your first month free at kinsta.com. That's KINSTA.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
I think one thing I would like to communicate to the American audience is that we are a transcultural, multicultural, multilingual people. Our themes are Indian, our language is English, our music can be Indian, we can also experience Western music in great depth. This is where we are, you know, culturally. And often that is not seen internationally.
Welcome to the True Fiction Project, a podcast series that explores the origins of fiction. Every week, we begin with an interview, nonfiction, followed by a creative piece, fiction, inspired by something from the interview. The idea is to demonstrate, of course, that fiction is born out of our life experiences. Now, here's your host, storyteller, author, public speaker, health and wellness expert, Renita Hora.
Welcome back to the True Fiction Project. This is your host, Renita Hora, and today is a particularly exciting day for me, not just because I am in Mumbai, where I am from, but I am back in Mumbai with a childhood friend of mine from school, from Sanskrit class. This is Anand Thakur. He is an Anglophone poet and a Hindustani classical musician. He has published collections of poetry, including In Praise of Bone, that came out last year, Waking in December, Elephant Bathing, and The Mughal Sequence, and much more. But I will let him get into that. I'm just so excited to launch into this conversation with him. Hi, Anand. Welcome to the True Fiction Project.
Hi, Renita. It's, yeah, a lot of water under the bridge since we were studying Sanskrit together.
We were indeed. And I feel that at this point in time, the water continues to flow under the bridge and I could be your student. I am your student. Anand, you were the star of the Sanskrit class. I remember so clearly, so vividly, everything you brought to the table. And of course, none of us had any crystal balls back then and arguably still don't. But if there was one person I think we could all envision would take the Sanskrit and carry it into the future, apply it, it had to be you. So I don't know where to begin, but tell me about your journey.
Well, that's very interesting because I when I left school, I initially started studying science, but then I abandoned that to go to a college that had a very good Sanskrit department. And I decided I was going to devote myself to the study of Sanskrit. And I did that for several years, but then realized that what I really wanted to do was study literature in the language I thought in and wrote in, which was English. And of course, the Sanskrit did apply to my study of music, and it has influenced my English poetry in many ways. But, you know, I can't say that I ever really mastered the language or anything like that. I didn't. And the strange thing is, when I was studying Sanskrit in cathedral, I'd just come back from England. So my mother had a job there. So I had this mixed sort of upbringing, which was in many ways very fruitful for me. I feel grateful for that.
Yes, indeed. I do remember. I remember that clearly. You had just come from England and your mother was, she was around. She was involved. She was very, very influential back then. So it's interesting to hear you say that perhaps that's a thread that continued. Would that be accurate?
Well, I think so. Yes. She was a very forward Indian woman for those times. So played a leading role in banking and stuff like that. And I think some of those genes did come into me. I felt free to do things, question things.
Right. So What started first, the music or the poetry, or are they interlinked, or are they the same and just different manifestations of the same art?
Well, the music started first much earlier as an art form, because it was an art form I had exposure to at home. My father played a little sitar. We listened to Hindustani classical music and Western classical and jazz, and I was taught music. I was brought up to think of myself as a potential musician. But what started long before any of this was the impulse to talk and say very clever things and draw attention to the things I said. I was an inveterate talker at the age of 4 or 5. People remember that. So I think...
An inveterate talker.
Yeah, I couldn't stop, you know. Like, my dad used to call me Basanti from Shole, you know, the character. Baskar Basanti.
Yes, Basanti. Talk a lot. From
Shole.
Shole, the Indian movie. So I definitely want to get into this conversation about your talk, the poetry. But before we do, I have one particular question that has actually come through from one of our classmates, who asks very curiously how the Dadra is going, whether this is something you have mastered. Has he mastered the elusive Dadra? Now... You're laughing. What exactly are we talking about here?
Well, now that it all comes back to me, I think in sixth standard, for a Diwali concert or something, Deepali Mathur and I sang a Tulsi Bhajan on stage, and it was in 6 beats. And the bhajan was Tumak Chalat Ram Chandra 1 2 3 1 2 3, and I think somewhere or the other I missed a beat over there, and Deepali corrected me on stage in front of the whole cathedral school. Just like this, not like that, hello. Something like that. I don't remember clearly. But I think I respected her. And I never forgave her, but I respected her for that. You know?
Of course, of course. And I chuckle because she did send me a text saying, of course, maybe ask him to guess who asked this particular question. It could only be 2 people. So Deepali, or who was the other?
And Ashok Devakaran would have been on the tabla.
Exactly. Spot on. Fantastic. So from music, Anand, to poetry. When did the poetry begin? And was there this natural transition? I mean, it's not really a transition. You do both. But you were always very talkative. More than talkative, I should say insightful. You always had very unique views, great poetic analysis. I remember when we were studying English and that kind of thing. But when and how did it translate into a creative profession?
Well, I wrote considerably in school and college, and I felt, along with my study of music and my riyas, a need to create something out of language. But most of what I wrote, say between 14 and 21, tended to be very scattered and directionless. What it needed was form. And it's strangely, when I left Bombay and went to Pune University to study English literature for my MA, I was alone, away from Bombay, away from the family I had grown up with, and just reading and looking for that poem. And here the influence of classical training does come in, but it's when I began to contain my thought in some sort of form, like a quatrain or a sonnet, or use rhyme, attempt to use meter, that I think I began to produce something that I felt confident about showing other people as a piece of writing, as a construct, as something made out of language, not just the random outpourings of a, you know, a linguistically talented person. There's something like fidelity to theme, which classical music teaches you. Stay true to the rag. Something about containing your thought in that many beats, for instance. Which that is what really got me writing seriously. And then I was showing my work to people like Don Moraes and Adil Jasawala and Arvind Nehrotra, and they were encouraging me. Dom was very impressed by my formal capacities as a poet, and he wrote about it in The Midday when I was in my early 20s. And that was very encouraging. And then, of course, I also explored much freer forms, that I couldn't keep myself trapped in an exercise. That was important for me, the formal aspect of it.
Indeed. And it's interesting, as you mentioned these names. I mean, Dom Moraes is a name that we have all grown up with, you know, an Indian writer and a poet who we would see his name in the newspaper, in publications all the time. So it's interesting to hear you also mention how he and others encouraged you to sort of evolve your art, but within the realms of a certain discipline, if I'm putting it correctly, not just to go free flow, wild, all over the place. And I feel like I must stop and ask you more about that, because in the West, I mean, I live in the US, as you know, it is very much encouraged to have a free flow of thought, a Waldorfian method, if you will, if that's the way your mind works, because apparently that fosters creativity. And I feel that in India, we come from a different place. Is this accurate? Or?
Well, not entirely. In fact, contemporary Indian writing is all over the place because it glorifies free flow in an attempt to imitate America without actually having free flow. Now, it's something you have to really have to create art like that. I won't say I completely lack it or anything, but a directionless free flow for me was not satisfactory personally. So I felt the need for containment and restraint, and also letting go. Hey, I also wrote in my later work, Mughal sequence and stuff like that is very free. But again, I need to be true to a character or a situation, if not a meter, or if not a rhyme scheme. I need to be true to something there. Pure chaos let loose for me was not art, but it can also be. I'm open to the option.
Right. Now, Mughal sequence, you mentioned that particular one. You had a very interesting and funny story about backstory, I should say, that led up to the creation of Mughal sequence. Or would you like to share that with us?
Well, yes, it's interesting. I mean, there are five characters there, all whom, some historical, some invented, who lived in the 16th century. And there's the royal household. And this, well, Jeet Thayil actually walked into my room one day. He was staying over. And he said, you know, the thing about Indian poets is they just write about themselves. American poets write about history. And I said, okay, well, I need to write something about history. And the same day it was announced that my ancestral house was going to be sold for demolition. And there I was thinking about Humayun losing his empire just after inheriting it. And the poem started with that, you know, losing your inheritance. And then there was another poem about Humayun's sister going on a pilgrimage all the way to Mecca, because I was going all over this city in search of home. So, you know, it's like my new home was the Tirthasthan, the pilgrim, the place of pilgrimage that I was trying to reach. Where is this new home? And then there was this story about a dancing girl who'd been sent off to Kabul by Babur as a present for his wife. She was just sent off from Delhi to Kabul, go there and perform for my wife. And that is how I felt when I finally moved to a Shivri, which was an area I'd never even seen before. And then I bought my new flat and I felt like an emperor. Then I felt like Babur, who had just conquered Hindustan. All he did was, he had vowed to give up alcohol, but then started using bhang. He writes about this in his diary. So I attempted to imitate the the whole thing while doing up my flat. And I wrote a long poem about Babur's vision of Hindustan, having just conquered it, but having given up alcohol. I mean, what's the point, you know, if you can't drink to be emperor of Hindustan? Unless you have a little bhang now and then. Unless you kabhi kabhi thoda bhang piyo yaar, to Hindi, you know, that sort of thing. Ma, forgive my Hindi, it may be inaccessible to the American audience. But all this, I think one thing I would like to communicate to the American audience is that we are a transcultural, multicultural, multilingual people. Our themes are Indian, our language is English, our music can be Indian, we can also experience Western music in great depth. This is where we are, you know, culturally. And often that is not seen internationally.
Right. Right. Well, I love it. I love the fact that you found your Mecca, your Tirthastan, and, you know, alcohol or not, or other things aside. And I'm definitely looking forward to listening to you read a little bit of Mughal sequence. But before we do that, what about, I mean, your work is so varied and so vast. So what about some of these other pieces of poetry? In Praise of Bone, your latest, or Waking in December, Elephant Bathing, Seven Deaths, Four Scrolls. Give us a little bit of backstory about some or one of these, anything that you would like to share?
All right. Waking in December was the first book, and I still have critics who feel it was my finest, and that is extremely disappointing to me. But this is a matter of varied opinion. And it was an exploration of two things. One was very strict forms, and the other was completely free flow. Yeah, just a free poem addressing an ex-lover's pet tortoise for 4 pages with no metrical structure to it, just a free flow. It was both things. And I think then it becomes more formal again in Elephant Bathing. And Mughal sequence opens out it as a form. The thing about Mughal sequence and the next book, Seven Deaths and Four Scrolls, is that they all center around single themes. Mughal sequence is a set of poems set in a particular period. Seven Deaths is a book in which each poem deals with a death of some sort. And I got tired of that method in Praise of Bone. I began to feel that poetry really has to embrace the moment and be very short and brief and make its statement in a short pace. And, you know, you do it quickly and move on. You can't just, it's not like a novel in which you develop something that the reader is going to stay with for days and days and days. I think I pushed poetry in the direction of theater with characters and the novel a lot in two books, and then began to tire of that method. It's something to do with growing old. We have less time left. We have to do it quickly. We have to say what we need to say and move. I can't sit and think about this theme and how I'm going to develop it now. Now it's all or nothing. You're going to do it in the next week or you're going to leave. And poetry's become like that for me now.
That's interesting. So with this early poetry, it was very much, I love the way you put it, the theater of poetry. So you were creating characters, story arcs, character development and journeys, that kind of thing within the poetry. Is that right?
I was, very much so. Like the soliloquy or the monologue, or the Kohinoor, for instance, is a character in Mughal sequence. At the end of Mughal sequence, it's this central consciousness that saw all this history, this diamond that happened to be in the crowns of all these monarchs and is now in the British crown. So it has seen that much history, and it talks about that.
So with the evolution, the later poetry is not necessarily character-based or theatrical, as you say, but how would you describe it? More as musing, self-reflection or observations of the world, or how would you put it in your own words?
More first person. And it's an interesting thing. Sometimes poets reveal themselves more when they're pretending to be someone else. I've just begun to read Milton again, and I can see how he's most at home when he's pretending to be Satan. Like, he can say things about himself as Satan that he can't say as a first-person narrator. And maybe that has something to do with the need for theater and characters. I can reveal myself when I am being the Kohinoor. Or maybe it's a need for distance from myself. Yeah, there's a certain kind of... maybe. On the other hand, the honesty of just being you on the page, this is me, and I am saying this directly, has a power that nothing can imitate. I think I'm returning to that. Although my last poem was a character, it was the last piece I wrote after my father died, was a sock puppet.
That's interesting. You were the sock puppet? Yourself in the sock puppet?
Partly, yes. Playing a role and talking about what it means to,
right,
to be an entertainer.
Yes, yes. Now, I can definitely identify with this thread because as a fiction writer myself, I love creating characters, and through those characters, I am communicating myself and other people and situations in life. But also sometimes I see what you mean by hiding behind a character, if maybe you put it in other words. But and the difference between that and just coming out and speaking in first person, it is quite an evolution. So I admire that. I respect that. I mean, intrigued by that, Anand. And I must say, you are such the accomplished poet. I mean, you are definitely one of the poets of our lifetime in India. And I couldn't be more proud of you and thrilled to speak with you about this, because it's such an example you are setting to everyone else beyond providing this material for us to read and absorb and take in. There was another one of our classmates who also wrote poetry, and you had a very deep bond with him, and you actually wrote an introduction to one of his collected works. Please do tell us more about this.
Yes, awesome. Well, Dipankar Kivani was in class with us, and we all studied under Dr. Krishnan when he taught us Shelley and Julius Caesar. And Dipankar was doing things like writing critiques of Shelley's To a Skylark at 14. I was doing nothing of the sort. He was way more evolved in his appreciation of literature at that age and his capacity to write. It had partly to do with the fact that his mother brought him up to do things like, you know, scansion. He knew what iambic pentameter was at 12.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Like, I knew rags. I didn't have to be taught how to recognize rags. My dad played them a little bit. You know, a little bit. He was not a professional, but it was enough for me to understand that. And so Dipankar wrote some great poetry. Talking about Dom, Dom was totally impressed by Dipankar. And in fact, he found me a bit too rebellious with form. Dom was a very orthodox sort of poet, and which means he expected you to write in 10 syllables and things like that. It was too much, like, you know, talking about people who are like the, not necessarily Indian, but the classical orthodoxy. Dom was very much into that. And Dipankar in his own way was, well, he was a bit of this and a bit of that, but he was very good at that sort of thing. But he turned his back on poetry for a large section of his life and devoted himself to other things. He passed away, of course, 3 years ago, and it was heartbreaking. A lot of the poems in Praise of Bone were inspired by my need to return to those original things that Dipankar and I discussed between 14 and 21. I started writing sonnets again and working with forms again, which I was not doing with set forms. And, well, there's a small poem by Dipankar about called Cathedral, which I will read in response. First, I want to say, Renita, that talking about theater and dramatic characters, I cannot forget your incredible capacity to act and elocute. You were one of the most articulate students in class. And there was debating, of course, and I think we were on opposite sides. And I was accused by Simran Mulchandani of elocuting when I should be debating. You can't just quote Shakespeare, man. Make the point.
That is such Simran thing to say, and we should have brought him right into this conversation as well. Thank you. Thank you.
Here is Cathedral by Dipankar Kivani. Now 37, I sometimes still sit at Mocambo and write on my napkins the usual questions. What growing up meant, what the city is, what I means. Then I walk past my old school and hear them practicing the anthem, school first, house next, self last, and comfort myself with that order of things beyond the high stone wall.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel, because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you, Deepankar, wherever you are. And thank you, Anand, for bringing that to us. I know that everybody who has walked those school hallways is going to be just thrilled with that. I mean, we never exit that aspect of theatricality, I think. We always play that role. So thank you for that. And I would love to know more about what you are going to read for us today from your own work.
Well, I think since I talked about form, I will read two sonnets, 14-line poems. And here are two poems, both in sonnet form. And in a sense, these were inspired by the first one, at least, is called Sea Link, which refers to the structure that joins South Bombay to North Bombay via the sea. And it's a response to this new structure in the city that is at once part of it and not a part of it. And I really relate to that. I feel a sense of belonging and not belonging to Bombay, both things. So here it is. Sea Link. A swerve to the left, and at last I can see from outside the city I was raised in. At the edge of the village on my right, a finger of rock laid bare by an ebbing tide, the skyline retreating in darkness and halogen light. Surely the voice at once spoke true and lied, that said I belong to this city of slums and towers. There's a side of me that wants to cast aside what links us together to commonly call it ours. And bound to it in concrete, this our very own brand new sea link remains inseverable from what I love and long to flee, though it claims to stand alone. Here none may linger, all must always move. It isn't true, but there's relief in pretending one is through, as taut white cables fly backwards above. And the next poem I'm going to read, also a sonnet, is something I wrote almost a week ago. With all these sock puppets bouncing up and down on the internet, I think I began to feel a bit like one. So it's called My Place. I was no one till a sudden hand sewed into my skin a beak and wings. I'm now a parrot from a mythic land who leaps and squawks and speaks and sometimes sings. I tell myself, as smiling crowds applaud, there is some meaning and some joy in this. I bring to playrooms and a children's ward the visions children see and grown-ups miss. Yet seated on my master's bedroom shelf, I see how I've been lying to myself. Relieve me of these roles I do not love. Disown me, hand. I'm tired of deceit. I have no wish to be a clowning glove. My place is at the soles of silent feet.
That is just beautiful. I have to ask, why are you feeling like a sock puppet? Or why were you?
It's many things. It's sometimes the social roles one is compelled to place. Strangely, this was written after the memorial session for my father after he passed away last year in November. And, you know, I was master of ceremonies at an event like that. And so it's, hey, we have to perform certain social functions. Now, it has something to do with putting on a social face when your feelings are so different from what you're showing. But I think it's a general theme. We, as performers, you are one too, and we know what it is to entertain. And in that process, we also adopt certain personae. I'm very skeptical of the adjective spiritual, but I tend to use it in my own mind. To be returned to your original function is part of that process. A sock is a sock. its place is not on your hand. You know, why am I here? I should be here.
This is so deep, so profound, so on point. It partly Shakespeare, back to the roles we play, right? All the world's a stage. And partly, why are you playing those roles? Or as you say, mourning is such a deep and personal process, but maybe in any culture, certainly in ours, it's almost like you're not allowed. It's like, push it aside, deal with it at another point, because you have the social role to play.
I'm glad you brought that up, because talking about our culture, and I use the word spiritual, and I couldn't but think of a line from a bhajan, which I'd heard as a kid, sung by Bhimsen Joshi. It's Tukaram. The line is Pai Chi Vahana Pai Bari, which means he's talking about himself before God. And he says, a chappal is meant to be placed, a pair of sandals is meant to be placed at the feet. So this is, it is complex. It is very, very complicated looking at that today. A very close friend of mine in Australia was saying, Anand, you have to think about the fact that this idea of the foot being the lowest part of the body has so much to do with caste and a lot of things like that. The idea that the Shudras came out of the feet of Brahma and the Brahmins came out of the head of Brahma. And we want to throw all that away. So how do we use traditional symbols, traditional imagery, if so much of it reeks of, you know, stuff we don't want? Of course, Tukaram doesn't mean it that way, but there's so much patriarchy, there's so much caste there.
So much patriarchy and caste. And then there's this beautiful idea of Matha Tekoing, where the energy you draw actually from the feet, the inspirational energy of the deity or the parent or the elder or whoever. Wonderful. Anand, before we wrap up, is there something you can share with us from Mughal sequence, since you gave us that beautiful story earlier? Of course, we are going to be linking to all of these. We'll be putting the various links to your books, to Dipankar's book, in our show notes and any other piece of information that you give us. But yes, we would love to hear something from the Mughal sequence.
Okay, so this is the last poem in Mughal sequence. It's the Kohinoor, the diamond that becomes a character in my sequence. And it has a little note to it, which I will read. It was finally forwarded to Queen Victoria, arriving in time to become the prize exhibit in the Great Exhibition of 1851. It is, of course, now in the Tower of London amongst the Crown Jewels. The Kohinoor, here in this tower, bound by gold clamps to thin walls of gold, I, who am pure mineral, neither mortal nor ghost, remain doomed to abide. Of those who are sent here, only the living escape. I endure the doom of rock, inhabited by light and never at home. No, never. Never for a minute since I was taken from the stomach of this earth, except perhaps through the week I dreamed unguarded, unpraised and unpossessed, in the waistcoat pocket of a British lieutenant who thought me worthless. Most men who held me beheld only what I showed them, and I saw much that their pride could not begin to see, though monarch and vassal alike, minion and minister, eunuch and page, cupbearer, concubine, courtesan and queen, only rarely guessed that I was watching. I have seen too many blindings, too many tremblings of oil lamps in mirrored paternal halls usurped by the young, the banishment of music, and the nervous weaving of recalcitrant cotton, where fountains had leaped and the peacock once danced. Too many orgies, too much opium, and too much penitence. Too many depraved flailings in the courtyards of mosques, and self-assured mastectomies of prurient goddesses by incensed believing hands to be moved or repulsed, intrigued or deceived. these things I have seen, and seen myself too often now in the sculpted faces of mute attendants, while ailing emperors clung to me in their slumber, then woke before death, envious of my transparence, but unaware of my gaze, staring right through me with opiate eyes, or eyes vermilion with wine. I, who have never cared to be a seer, have seen these things, and ask only now to be sheltered from the light that can never be mine. Return me to the mines, carry me back to the dark that scorned me.
Thank you, Anand. That was just beautiful. The Kohinoor is so topical. It's become topical again recently. Yeah. Especially after the passing of Queen Elizabeth and what's going to happen with it. And I can totally understand now what you were saying earlier about it being a character, speaking as the character or from behind that diamond. Anand, thank you so much for being on the True Fiction Project. I am so thrilled to talk with you. And honestly, I could go on and on. I feel that it's a shame to cut it short, but I think we'll have to bring you back to the podcast to talk more about your music and poetry. Two different things.
Sure, we must do that. And thank you so much, Renita. It's been a total joy and pleasure to talk about all these things with you and to reminisce about school and the whole journey from there to here. It's been wonderful.
Wonderful indeed. And that, everybody, was Anand Thakur, a musician, a poet, a very old soul, a very old school friend, not just in those hallowed halls of cathedral, but in the school of life. Thank you, Anand.
Thank you, Renita.
And I am your host, Renita Hora, for the True Fiction Project.
Life can be chaotic. If you're running a retail business, don't let disorganized order fulfillment add to the chaos. Use ShipStation instead. With ShipStation, you never have to worry about shipping and fulfillment again. Whether you're running a business out of your garage or you have multiple warehouses, ShipStation is ideal for every phase of your business's growth. Save time with one login for all your stores and by automating repetitive tasks. Plus, you'll save money with the best shipping rates from global carriers. ShipStation's industry-leading features help you deliver a better customer experience. They'll get accurate and faster shipments, along with automated tracking updates with your branding. And with up to 88% off UPS and USPS rates, and up to 90% off FedEx rates, ShipStation is the fastest and most affordable way to ship. Calm the chaos. Switch to ShipStation today. Start a free trial at ShipStation.com/audio. That's ShipStation.com/audio.